Just got a free coffee with my EarnIFI points.
Your what?
The points I get with the new EarnIFI app from BP and Amoco. I got 250 for signing up and more every time I fill up or buy anything in the C-store.
Oh, can you use points for fuel?
Of course.
And discounts and deals?
On anything.
Oh, like chips?
Mm-hmm.
Sodas?
You got it.
The actual slushy machine.
Only what's actually for sale. But you do get double the points for the first 90 days. Just go to EarnIFIRewards.com to download the app.
Available at participating locations only. App content is subject to change.
They are Sports Illustrated.
It's amazing.
This incredible body of work.
I really appreciate the integrity.
Everything you do is well done.
You guys do a great job.
We love it. What can we say?
He's Chris Mannix.
He's employed by Sports Illustrated.
The announcer's got it in for me.
There you go.
This is the Crossover NBA Podcast.
You have a problem with it? Build a team that can beat them.
Hosted by the one and only.
Oh, thank God.
Thank God.
Chris Mannix.
All right, welcome back to the Crossover NBA Podcast. On this episode, we'll get into the devastating news of Kevin Durant's injury, what that means for what was already expected to be a wild offseason. We'll get into Game 6, bring Golden State and Toronto, the final game, thank God, at Oracle Arena. And we'll also touch on the latest chatter involving Anthony Davis. As always, the best way to support this podcast, head over to Apple Podcasts where you can post a rating or leave a comment. It's easy. It's free. It's the best way to make sure that we keep doing this podcast week after week. Also, if you like boxing, subscribe to the SI Boxing Podcast hosted by yours truly. That podcast comes out every week. Finally, the SI NBA Draft Show is back. We'll have a live show on SI.com on draft night. More details will be announced next couple of days, but we'll have some strong NBA and college basketball presences, as well as experts from our SI.com staff. I will be hosting it and taking you through the entire first round. All right, joining me now in studio, you can see her on Nets broadcasts on the Yes Network. You can see her here or see her on FS1. You can also see her calling WNBA games. She is my former friend, Sarah Kustok, back on the show. Hi, Sarah.
You're starting early.
I am, yes. Do you want to just rip the Band-Aid off here early, why you're my former friend?
I thought I'm still your friend.
No. I when people become dead to me, they're dead to me.
I thought you were joking when you sent that text.
And I did, was
you
not.
Never responded back.
I did
was
not.
Like, oh, yeah. You may really mean this.
Dead
until
to me.
He needs another podcast.
So Sarah, exactly. Until I need something. Until it becomes about me again. So Sarah went to the Gennady Golovkin fight. Was that your first?
It was my first fight ever.
First fight. Your thoughts on
tremendous.
A major boxing event?
I want to go every weekend.
Well, I'm not getting you tickets again. So I'll for people that don't want to hear the story, like Sarah goes to the Golovkin fight. She has a great time. She goes to Rebecca Harlow, you know, from MSG Networks. And then I sent a text like right before the main event, like, if you guys go out and get a drink, I'd be happy to. I'd love to meet you guys out somewhere around the arena. Sarah goes out to get a drink right next door at the Affinia Hotel in the hotel bar there.
And I said, come meet. We're going to be right across the street. Make it easy for you.
I said, yeah, I'm wrapping up.
After a late night of work.
25, 30 minutes. Happy to come over. Love to come over. I'm walking out of the arena door when Sarah Kustok texts and says, you're going to hate me, but I'm leaving. I'm dead tired. I'm like, I'm literally minutes away. And it was like, I already left. Gone. Out the door. So you, because I'm a very petty person, you drop all the way down in my team broadcaster power rankings. Not below Grady, your broadcast partner, but Grady is number 31 on the sideline reporter power rankings. I firmly believe Fan for a Day is better than Grady on the sideline. Olsendam was 29. You're now, she's now 28. You're 29.
So I'm in great company. If I'm near Brooke and Grady, I'm in excellent company.
No. Just
it was, I can't stay out that late. I'm not
it was
cool
like midnight.
You. I'm not cool like
it
you.
It was, okay, if I had texted you at 3 a.m., like, hey, come on out. Like, that's one thing.
You know when you hit a point and you're just, I'm done?
Yeah, you had hit that point.
I was hungry, too.
There's food around. You're in Midtown.
I just wanted
to go home. Okay, that's...
I owe you.
Uh-huh, yeah. Walking out the door. You and Harlow, both gone. She's dead to me, too. I'm going to throw her a list. I don't even know her
cares.
That well, but she's
I
dead to me.
Exactly. You may already be dead to her.
That's fine. All right. All right.
Chris who?
Wow, it's like that. Even in New York.
No.
Hurts. Feelings hurt. Anyway, We'll see if you can get the friendship back on track. We'll figure that
I'm
one out.
Try.
Maybe next time I need a second podcast. all right, let's talk about Kevin Durant's injury. Game five, great win for Golden State. Brutal moment in the aftermath of it. Kevin Durant, as we record this, we don't know exactly the extent of the injury. It's believed to be an Achilles tear. It is, as we know, an Achilles injury. Kevin Durant likely going to miss most or all of next season if that is the diagnosis. Bob Myers, the general manager of the Warriors, extremely emotional in the aftermath of the injury. He addressed the media, took a couple of questions. One of the things that Bob Myers said was that there should be no blame passed around after all this. Do you agree that there is nobody to blame for all this?
I think it's very hard to speculate the process by which they decided that this was in fact the game that he was going to play, that he was ready to play. It's hard to be on the outside looking in of who really is to blame. And I agree with that in the sense of he needs to be cleared by the doctors. Obviously, Bob Myers said he's in charge of basketball operations, so that's why. But I imagine too, Kevin is one of the elite basketball players that we have ever seen. In a lot too, I'm sure he was dying just to play, to get back on the floor, to be on that stage, to be in the finals. So I don't know what was articulated to him, the potential risks, if there were potential risks of being back out there. But I have a hard time trying to blame people a situation like that. It's tragic. It's awful. I think it was heartbreaking for all of us to see and to watch. However, when I look at a situation like that, to me, there's no looking back and saying, gosh, this person or that person, the doctors, or I can't believe they let him play, or there was pressure to have him play. That I don't buy into.
I don't know if outside pressure played a role in all this. I hope not. I don't know if they let Kevin Durant overrule the medical staff. I hope not. One thing that stands out to me that we do know is that Kevin Durant had virtually no practice time before he came back out there. And it's a lot to ask a guy with a lower leg injury that even Steve Kerr admitted earlier in the finals that they want to be careful that a bad injury doesn't become worse at some point if you come back out on the floor. When guys are overcoming big stuff, use DeMarcus Cousins as an example, they practice a lot. You know, they go out there and they do full speed 5-on-5s until they're ready physically to go out there and play. Durant didn't have that. And that's the big question. I didn't get a chance to ask Bob Myers this question. They kind of limited it to the local media with asking questions. But I would ask him, is there any regret in not seeing more of Durant on the practice floor before you dropped him into a finals game? Because it's not like you're dropping him into a February game against Sacramento. You're dropping him into an elimination game for your team. And that's as high pressure as you can get. That to me, I wonder if he had more practice time and more of a chance to loosen that leg up and get it used to the situation, would that have prevented this from happening?
Well,
that's a question.
And those I think are all the excellent questions. I tore my calf, and I think I was talking about this prior to him even coming back. I said, one, we know with injuries, you overcompensate. So obviously sometimes there's a liability with other parts of your body because of that. Two, I just remember with mine when I was trying to come back, like sometimes it just does not trigger. It's not a pain tolerance thing. It's not I want to play through this. Things do not work or they do not trigger. But I think in this scenario, and that's such a great point, you're going back into, this isn't even the regular, this isn't even going from, okay, I've practiced a lot. Like think about when guys are getting back and they're practicing and they're doing 5-on-5 and you're spending a couple days or a couple weeks doing this and then you're getting back in a regular season game. This is as high intense that it ever is going to get. So I think that is something to consider. However, when you look back, like think about watching him in warmups and the bounce he had and the dunks he was doing and, oh, he looks good. And then the first part of the game when he was a lot of the catch and shoots early. But he looked so good, and he played, what, 10 of the first 12 minutes? 12 of the first 14 minutes?
The burst, like Steve Kerr said, he'd play him in bursts. That really wasn't burst.
No.
That was pretty extended.
So there's a – and again, I don't think you point to any one thing, but when you – the totality of all those different factors, and I don't even know if people would do things differently. You know, they're trying to – they're down 3-1. This is an elimination game. So I just think it's hard to not be in the conversations, to not know what was said, to not know how it transpired, to not know what Kevin had decided going in, what the medical staff told everyone. I think there's so much more to it, but I do think, given the fact that teams don't practice in the finals and there's no real five-on-five, you're not getting up and down, you're not getting that type of work before you go into it, that happening, then looking back, you can kind of see that maybe it's a situation that, you know, I don't know if they regret it. I don't know if they would have changed what they did, but obviously it's something that is just horrific to watch given the circumstances and a player like Kevin.
Your mind goes a lot of places after an injury like that, but one of the places my mind went to was to Kawhi Leonard and everything Kawhi Leonard went through last year, and there was a lot of outside pressure. Frankly, there was some internal pressure in San Antonio to get him back on the floor to make a run with that group that was currently there with Manu and Tony Parker and see if you can get one more year out of all of them. And you start thinking, like, Kawhi Leonard was right. Like, he did it the right way. I mean, it's tough to see your team go out in the postseason without you being a part of it. But where would Kawhi Leonard be if he had come back and re-injured himself? Would he be sitting here, as we speak, one game away from a championship and a second finals MVP? This is just, I think, further evidence that players shouldn't let any outside pressure influence them. Whatever's being said in the media, whatever's being whispered through sourced material, you know, I know that Sam Amick wrote a piece where he, you know, quoted people around some of the players in that team, said there was confusion and angst about Durant's situation. That's been cited often as some of the outside pressure Durant was feeling. But if you're a player and you don't feel you're all the way right, don't play, because this is the kind of thing that isn't just possible to happen. It's maybe almost likely to happen if you get hurt like
well,
this.
Well, and to go further on that, yes, I hope the players block out all of that noise. I hope the noise stops. Like, at what point do we not realize it's unfair to have any opinion on when a player should be coming back or how much they should be playing, for us not knowing anything and watching.
And there's a difference, too, between Kevon Looney playing with like a collarbone injury and Kevin Durant with a leg injury. You're probably not going to exacerbate a collarbone injury or Kyle Lowry with his thumb. Like, it's this playing through pain and this playing injured. They're right. Two very different things.
But even say, which one, I agree, but two, to even speculate on that. Like, oh, this person, I believe in that article you're referencing, would Clay, I think the question was posed at the end, would Clay or Draymond be playing, or maybe it was Kevin, but whoever be playing if this was the same circumstance. There's no same circumstances. And that's why it's unfair to even have a thought or opinion or speculation on what a player should do. And I do. I think Kawhi, like, credit to Kawhi, credit to him believing what he did, knowing his body. I think everyone knows their body the very best. And obviously you have the help of these medical staffs and others that are experts and professionals in those fields. But, like, come on. I hope this is a very clear example, which we've seen many of them, where people can stop putting their two cents about what a player should be doing with their body.
And so many guys play through so much pain at all times, like more than people even realize. Like, I'm curious to see what Kawhi's been playing through, because
yes,
really ever since the second round of the playoffs, maybe it was the conference finals, he has been dragging his leg around. It's gotten better to a degree in the finals, but I'm sure he's playing through something significant there. So everybody's going through something. Kevin Durant now has the option of entering free agency. Before, it seemed like a no-brainer. Now, most likely, but he still can trigger that $31.5 million player option, come back and recover while still a member of the Warriors. If Kevin Durant enters free agency with this injury, how much do you think that changes the calculus? Do teams feel like they shouldn't? Do you think that there'll be teams that pull back on offering him a max contract because he's likely out for all or most of next season?
I don't think it changes anything. I really don't. And from a handful of those I've spoken with, but just in general, I don't think it changes a thing. He's one of the best players in the world. He's 30 years old. Even if you're going to have to give up a year or however long it takes for him to rehab, to come back, like, you still are getting one of, I believe, someone that's going to return to be one of the best players in the world. And that, given the landscape of the NBA and given the type of opportunity that would still have in changing and helping your franchise? No, I really don't. I think the teams that wanted him are still going to want him. And I think that, you know, is something that may calculate into what other players do or decisions you're making or how else you're building the roster. However, I don't think that changes the offers that he's going to get.
Yeah, I agree. I think that there'll be plenty of teams, the New York teams included, that would make an offer of 4 years for Kevin Durant and live with getting three, basically. You're let him rehab all next season and bring him back, hopefully at 100% in the second year of that deal, and hope you can win with a then 32-year-old Kevin Durant for 3 years. But do you think it'll be a tough call for him? Because, you know, he could always trigger that option and enter free agency in 2020 when there'll still be some teams with cap space, enter free agency with Anthony Davis as well being a free agent. So maybe they could talk about potentially teaming up in the summer of 2020. Think it'll be a tough call for him to decide whether or not to trigger that option.
Well, even so, I mean, he would, despite the fact it's what, $31.5 million?
Yeah.
Is it, he would still be losing money.
Correct.
With what he would sign in terms of a contract. I also think, and again, this goes back to the assumption that he wants to leave Golden State and, you know, that he wouldn't want to stay there long term. But if that's the case, I would think Kevin has an idea or will have an idea whenever he really buckles down and thinks about this of where he wants to go, where he wants to play. And I don't necessarily see that. He's the one that's driving most of free agency. So whether he does have a conversation with AD or where he wants to eventually land, I think more of it is Kevin Durant is going to drive what happens still. So he will make a decision on where he wants to be, and that's something that, and again, who knows, and he has the agency to do whatever he wants in this circumstance, but to choose where he wants to be, and then he can be in that place and in the organization, have them care for him, have them see him through rehab. I mean, that also, too, is just the trust and comfort of the place you want to be at, understanding that they will know everything about your body and what you're going through and how to best get you back to the point you want to be at. So we'll see. But I would think, you know, but my two cents about it is that he would want to, if he knows where he wants to be, that's a place that he would try and get to, you know, this summer rather than waiting.
I think the upside in exercising the option is that you come back and you're going to come back to a team that there'll be zero pressure for you to play next year, even though you're making $31.5 million. Nobody in their right mind come next April is going to be saying, where's Kevin Durant? Why won't he come back? We're about to make a playoff run. After what just happened, he has a free pass from Golden State Warriors, and I would think their fan base all of next year. If he goes somewhere else, let's use New York as an example. If they're in the playoffs, if they sign two players like Kyrie Irving, and they're in the playoff mix in March or April, you don't think the New York papers and the New York media is going to be putting a lot of pressure on Kevin Durant to get back out there and play? Not that he should,
right,
but that he'll be getting it out there. I think there'll be there's no pressure going back to Golden State on that deal, a lot of pressure elsewhere. And if you go back to Golden State and you recover the way most players have recovered, all of a sudden you're looking at kind of a 5-year deal, right? Because you're taking the $31.5 million from Golden State and you enter the offseason and you're going to get a 4-year deal from somebody else at full max level money. So it's kind of a 5-year deal without having to sign the 5-year deal right away for Kevin Durant. Those are the only two reasons
I think those are great reasons. And I think that very well could happen. I will say, though, to the thought, which it makes sense about, we're in the playoffs and you've been practicing and could he come? I think all of that has been eliminated given the circumstance of what just happened. I don't think I would like to think as well that there wouldn't be any, whether by media attention or fan attention.
Putting a lot of faith in the back page headlines of the New York papers that they wouldn't.
You'd got to block that out. You got to block that
but
out.
But I'm just saying it's going to be there.
You would think even after, I mean, we're really getting ahead of ourselves here, but even after what happened in this circumstance, I think this, and after the talk about it, after the media attention on it, and then he goes out and he sacrifices his health, and then gets injured. To me, that returns back to the, I've been through this before and I did that and I went out there and then I got hurt. So I think either it would be lessened, or I think by now, hopefully, he would not feel any bit of that push or that pressure. And the organization he was with wouldn't put any of that on him.
Yeah, I think, look, I do think that opting out and signing a long-term deal elsewhere is a smart play, because you got to take the bird in the hand. And if you believe, and Rich Kleiman believes, that there's multiple max-level offers out there from the same teams that you've been thinking about going to, you take it. It's like with John Wall, you know, and where would he be if he didn't take the bird in the hand?
Yeah.
You know, if he had waited and said, maybe I can get a supermax contract in a couple of years, he wouldn't be in the position he is now, overcoming an injury but still having $170 million coming his way. There's always a risk with injury like this that you re-injure it at some point in midseason, or you don't recover in the same way. And that, and teams out there might say, well, maybe you're too big a risk to offer the four-year max contract. I do think that the smart play for Durant is to opt out. And maybe it's Golden State you go back to
exactly.
on a four-year deal. Yep. But wherever it is, if you can get four-year max, you take that this summer.
Yeah. Yeah. Just for his own peace of mind and security. And that's why I do think we, you know, maybe things, you never know how this shifts to his mindset of where he wants to be, or how he prioritizes things, or what makes him feel most comfortable in the next spot that he's going to go to.
Yeah. Now, the ripple effect, as you kind of touched on a minute ago, was other free agents that may want to play with Kevin Durant. And I think it's most going to be most strongly felt, at least from an outside perspective, on Kyrie Irving. Because Kyrie... he has been connected to Kevin Durant for months now. Ever since the Knicks traded Kristaps Porzingis and everybody started talking about the Kyrie KD union, there was that All-Star game video of them talking in the hallway like they're going to fucking talk about free agency in the hallway in the middle of All-Star with all these cameras that are present. That was a little bit too deep in the weeds even for me. But I wonder how Kyrie reacts to all this, because wherever he goes next year, if it's not Boston, he's going to be on his own, you know, most likely. Because if it's New York and they get KD and Kyrie, he's not going to play next year. If it's Brooklyn and the Nets, they want to get both as well, he's not going to play next year. So wherever he's going, he's probably going to have to deal with a tough year. You know, the Knicks could go out and acquire Anthony Davis, but even if they do, the roster will be so gutted that it's not going to be an easy year for Kyrie Irving next year. How big an impact do you think this Durant injury has specifically on Kyrie Irving?
I think it has, and not even in a negative way, I think it has more of an impact on Kyrie, or potentially his decision-making, than even the other teams and what they would offer to Kevin. Because I think, to me, it's fairly clear-cut that teams would steal, the teams that want him, the teams would offer to Kevin still will. I think for Kyrie, it's tough to say, because who knows what Kyrie is thinking and what he wants to do and where he's going to decide to go. But it is that sense of, does he feel like he still wants to be at the forefront of a team and lead a team and have his own team? Did he start to be open and embrace the fact that he needed someone else along with him? However, I don't know if it seems as though we're looking at the same number of teams, the same list of teams that were the potential landing spots of these guys. So I don't know if it changes Kyrie's decision on where he goes. It may change the year he's in for. It may change how he needs to approach the season that he's the season he's set up for. But I also don't know if it was a necessarily done decision that me and Kevin are definitely going to go to the same place. And that's the thing that you never know. And you never know how guys are looking at free agency or looking at their final destination they want to be at. But I'm not certain that Kyrie was, okay, me and Kevin are going to talk and discuss. And of course, there was that report that he flew out.
I'd want to add, wherever Kyrie Irving signs, I'd want to know if that's true or not. Like that he flew to the Bay Area.
To try to convince Kevin.
That just doesn't sound like the Kyrie Irving I've covered over the years, that he would go and fly out there during the finals to recruit Kevin Durant.
I don't know.
Do you buy into that?
I don't know. I take everything kind of with a grain of salt that we hear.
That's a lick of salt right there as well.
However, I don't. So that's the thing. I don't know if it was I don't know if it's a Kyrie's made up his mind where he wants to go and he's trying to get KD there. I don't know if it's, you know, vice versa, the same thing. But I do think it factors in. Mm-hmm. I do think it factors into probably just the process that Kyrie's going through in making the decision.
So the place that Kyrie's being connected to the most is Brooklyn, where you work with the Nets. The fit of Kyrie Irving there. Let's assume that KD doesn't sign there. And let's assume for the sake of argument that D'Angelo Russell is back there. D'Angelo's coming off an all-star season in Brooklyn. If he is back, it means he's getting paid a significant amount of money entering restricted free agency. There's got to be a belief if they sign Kyrie and put him there that those two can play together. You know how D'Angelo plays. You know how Kyrie plays. How do you think those two exist in the same backcourt?
I think they absolutely can exist and thrive together with one another. And I know the common thought has been when this was first discussed and talked about, they're two ball dominant guys and they need the ball in their hands, and how their styles in some way can be deemed similar and what they need offensively. But I think, like, we've seen, and especially you look at just the backcourt in general, or the playmakers and guards that they do have, not only with D'Angelo, but Spencer Dinwiddie, Caris LeVert, guys that can create. But I think we've seen all three of those guys in LeVert, Dinwiddie, and Russell be on the floor together. We've seen Kenny Atkinson do some unique things with his combinations by which he's gotten them to fit into the offense because of their unique skill sets. D'Angelo Russell's a guy, he's not a downhill guy. You know, he's not a downhill guy. He's a prober. He's got an excellent three-point shot. He could open up the floor. Great vision. I think a lot of those things you could say about Kyrie. Of course, he is different in D'Angelo with the way that he can get to the basket and all the things that we've seen him do throughout the years. But I think with those two, anytime you can add another playmaker on the floor, I feel like Kenny Atkinson has figured out ways to make it work within the context of the offense because the way they move the ball. And I think, too, he's shown an ability to help guys develop. And the maturity question or the leadership questions are with Kyrie. That's something where Brooklyn has laid down a foundation and a culture by which they get guys to buy in. And I think that would be, you know, part of the challenge and part of the approach of how do we get Kyrie to fit in with the rest of the guys and the way in which we need everyone to understand that it's not just about one guy. It's not just about having a star, but the skill set of Kyrie, and to have someone with that type of talent, I think is something that, you know, would just bode well for the Nets, given the core of guys they have, the youth that they have, you know, even the young guys, and, you know, Jared Allen and some of the bigs, Joe Harris, what he's done. I mean, you can kind of go down the list, but it's been a steady build for Brooklyn. But I think the idea and the notion of getting someone with that type of talent, you know, I think they could make fit and they could make work together.
You know, you used the phrase buy-in, and Danny Ainge said this recently, that he didn't feel like last season the Celtics had 100% buy-in. And part of that is you had young guys that had a bigger role the year before, that said all the right things but still wanted that bigger role and didn't have it with Kyrie coming back and with Gordon Hayward coming back. We can debate whether Kyrie and D'Angelo fit together offensively, but for D'Angelo, the challenge would then be, you were just an all-star. You're probably not going to be an all-star with Kyrie Irving alongside you. There's just not enough shots for you to get those types of opportunities. And you're going to have to accept that you're the point guard, kind of, but Kyrie's the point guard. It's on a bigger level what Terry Rozier dealt with. I mean, Terry Rozier had to go to being a backup. That's a tougher pill to swallow. But when he was in the game, he wasn't always a point guard. When he was alongside Kyrie, he was a two, and he was maneuvered in and out, and he really struggled with that and struggled on the floor and struggled to accept that because he was coming off a year where he established himself in a short period of time as a legitimate NBA point guard. That's something that, and maybe you can speak to D'Angelo's mindset, but I don't know how, if you're a young player that just established yourself, how willing would you be to modify your game and change your game? Because he would have to change his game to a degree if Kyrie Irving is alongside him.
Well, and I think that's where there is some track record, given the fact that D'Angelo and Spencer Dinwiddie were on the floor together, LeVert and Russell were on the floor together, whereby some guy, there was times they were on the ball, there was times they were off the ball. So I don't think there was always the truest sense of who's the point guard, because different players would have the ball in their hands and be, there's no necessarily traditional point guard role. So I think that is something it wouldn't be as challenging. I think that's an excellent point about just defer, you know, whether it's the shot volume, whether it's not getting as many shots, as many touches, as much attention. However, I think, like, D'Angelo, I was so impressed and blown away with his ability. And there was a lot of talk about him being coached and him embracing being coached tough by Kenny Atkinson. Even early parts of the season, he got benched in the fourth quarter, and he would come back the next game and be tremendous. His attitude and his mentality was always steady, and there was nothing that really wavered his confidence. And I think at this point in his career, and for many of these guys, and that's what I mean about the buy-in, they just wanted to win. And that's something that you say, but I think they're starting to get a taste of that and realizing that that may take away some of the shine from their game or from the attention that they get. However, if it ends up translating into wins, this group, that was a visible thing. You could see that in how they played and what they did. So I think if there is this notion that we are going to get an all-star level player that's going to come and it's going to help us to be better, I think that's something. Because D'Angelo then would have had a contract. He has established himself. And not to say the Terry Rozier situation isn't somewhat similar, but I think it's very different what Rozier was trying to do and the contract he's trying to get and where he's trying to establish himself in the league and with his career, as opposed to where D'Angelo might be at this point.
It's a chicken and the egg thing too with the buy-in, because you have to buy in to get wins, but you win when you buy in, right? So you kind of, and that's what Boston dealt with all last year. I mean, they had as much or more talent than anybody in the conference, maybe anybody in the league outside of Golden State, but their guys never bought in. They were never on the same page. That's what I worry about with D'Angelo there, because if he's back, he'll have a big contract, he'll be an established all-star, and how will he feel about some of those nights where he's taking like less than 10 shots? Because those will, maybe not frequently, but those right. will happen with that group. The other part of it is, you know, it's well documented, and I've said it on this podcast before, but the relationship between Kyrie and Brad Stevens, not great for most of the year. I mean, Kyrie indicated it got better as the season went on, but they were just kind of an oil and water type of mix, with Brad Stevens being very process oriented, wanting to get better every single game. And I've said this before, but Kyrie coming from the Cleveland school of the regular season, where it's like, let's just 82 games, let's just get through it because we got LeBron, we got Kyrie, we got veterans, let's flip a switch and get to the playoffs. Kenny Atkinson strikes me as someone whose mindset is closer to Brad Stevens than it is Tyronn Lue, who coached those Cavs teams. Where do you stand on that?
I would agree with that. And I think, I mean, there are few people I adore and respect more than Kenny Atkinson. And just not only the job he's done, and match that into the entire coaching staff and Sean Marks and how diligent they are about not just the players and the talent, but also the character. And they look into that. And I think that's something that I would think they've done their due diligence. If in fact, you know, this does continue to go through, or just the pursuit of Kyrie or however this all works out in free agency. But I do think Kenny is someone that he earns it every single day. And that's the off season. That's the preseason. That's expectation of the regular season, obviously the postseason. So I do think that would be something that, if, you know, Kyrie has had in the past difficulty of really buying into that throughout the regular season, I think that that would be a part of it. And I have all the respect in the world for Brad Stevens. So I just think that relationship, I've seen Kenny Atkinson really just flourish with point guards, and whether it's the D'Angelo Russell and him coming in and in the maturity that he's shown, Spencer Dinwiddie, who is a guy who they pulled basically from the Bulls, you know, G League now, and the growth that he's made, and just having a personality that's not, it's not always easy. There's been some push pull because of the way these guys work and want to get better. So I think, you know, with Kenny, there is a trust that he can figure out a way to get the best out of a player, to connect with a player, to relate with a player, to get him to understand what everyone else is doing. And I think Kenny treats everyone the same. That's what everyone has always said. And so that would be a part of it. He would treat Kyrie how he's treating Theo Pinson, how he's treated, you know, whoever on the roster. So, yeah, I mean, I think that would be a part of the expectation from the Brooklyn side of it or from Kenny Atkinson, the coaching staff side of it, and the hope that Kyrie would really embrace that, and that would be something that he would be able to work with.
Everything you just said there literally describes Brad Stevens and the Celtics. Whether it's all the guys over the first 4 years of Brad's career that he got better, that he got paid.
Do you think Kyrie though learned something from that Boston experience that maybe there's probably things that he wish were different from the and this is assuming that Kyrie doesn't want to be there anymore.
Right.
He chooses not
to
be there.
Which is still open-ended question.
So I don't want to presume that isn't an option still. But do you think there's parts of, because he didn't, you know, they didn't advance to the postseason. They didn't get as far as they wanted to do the regular season this last year.
So you mean maybe he was shocked into thinking, having his mindset changed?
Yeah, maybe at some point he looks back at it and say, okay, there's things I wish they did differently. There's things I would do differently. Here I now have another opportunity to look at things from a different perspective, because now I have for the second time a coach in an organization that's got an excellent track record telling me that this is the way we're doing things. So maybe I'll tweak how I approach things.
If that's the case, I don't know why you wouldn't go back to Boston, because it's, I don't think you can argue that the Celtics have kind of a better core of talent to win right now, to be championship ready at the moment. You put Kyrie on Brooklyn and they're a better team, but I don't know if they're a championship level team just yet. Kyrie comes back and, you know, even if they don't make a big deal and everybody kind of just figures it out, maybe Terry Rozier's gone and you take that piece out of the equation, they tinker a little bit with the roster, they're still a team that would enter the regular season as one of the top two, you know, depending on what happens to Toronto, one of the top contenders in the conference. If Kyrie learned something from last year, I don't know why he wouldn't just go back to the Celtics. It seemed like if he leaves, part of it will be New York. You know, he's got a strong bond there that, you know, grew up in northern New Jersey. But he'd be basically going to Boston Light out there. I mean, the team that's built kind of like the Celtics, with a coach who's kind of like Brad Stevens, with a general manager who's kind of like Danny Ainge. It's just like he'd be going to like a facsimile of what the Celtics are. And I don't really understand the thinking, unless he just hated it in Boston so much, which would be like, given what he said in October and that commercial he made with his father where he's like, I want to see my number up there in the rafters, like it would be just an incredibly steep fall or a steep change of heart over a span of months for Kyrie Irving.
Which, but that's a crazy thing. Like, even for us, and even when we speculate or assume or try and think we know what a player's thinking or what they're going to do, I think so much happens in a season. We all live through it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, every single month sometimes feels like a year of how much changes or how you look at things different. And sometimes if it wasn't a fit for Kyrie, and I jive with everything you're saying just about the organizations themselves, sometimes you just need to start fresh. Sometimes it's being around those people. Maybe he thinks about this and decides, you know what, maybe I need to give this another try. Maybe this is a better fit for me. But I also do think the draw, like there could be a major draw given the fact that this is home for him. But I don't know. I think just we can never, I just always think you can never underestimate how much a year or a season or a few months a player can mature or look at things a different way or have a different perspective or find ways when they ultimately just want to win and they think that there's a pathway to that or a certain point of growth or that he can help get an organization to a place that they haven't been before or have not been in a while, that can't be a draw for a player, and that maybe their approach and the way that they look at things.
I'm also
change.
Curious about the for the Nets perspective. Like, I understand that Kyrie and Durant makes a ton of, you get those two guys, absolutely, go in. But with Durant kind of out of the equation, at least for next year, and maybe out of the equation altogether, is there not, or should there not be a rethinking of the approach to the offseason? Because you kind of know what you are with D'Angelo Russell. And as long as D'Angelo Russell doesn't cost full max this summer, and if you can get him at a reasonable price, you kind of know what he is and know what you are with him. I feel like there are other holes in that team that are more glaring at this point. Like Tobias Harris to Brooklyn makes a ton of sense to me.
Yeah,
like that,
absolutely.
That's a guy that you just saw in the playoffs, like what he can do. He is a tremendous locker room guy. He makes shots. He's still like 26 years old, 27 years old, whatever he is at this point. So you know you're going to get like, you know, 3 or 4 good years out of him. You plug Tobias Harris onto the Nets.
Can you call Tobias and tell him all these things?
Yes,
and tell him the Nets are a good fit for him?
I think the Sixers are going to wind up paying a lot of money for some of their guys if they keep them
right.
all. Sorry, but that to me on an organic level makes more sense than a roll of the dice on just Kyrie Irving. If it's just Kyrie and you got to wind up either breaking up that team or figuring out how to play them and D'Angelo together, that's a pretty big roll of the dice.
But I also think that's, and I'm not speaking from the Nets' perspective. This is just my thoughts on it and being around it and in my opinions. So one, this isn't the thoughts of the Nets. And two, you know, who knows what happens or how things shuffle up, but like a part of that's the Allen Crabbe trade cleared a lot of room and a lot of space and gave them flexibility with the opportunities that they have to sign other guys. So there's still opportunity to sign a Kyrie, you know, if the Durant thing doesn't work out, or again, there's a lot of options, and I'm not going to act like I'm totally in tune with where they're at with the cap and the numbers and how all contracts could fit. But I think you could still get multiple guys. There's still room to get other guys. So it's not necessarily, if you strike out on Kevin Durant, there's still room for a Kyrie and a Tobias Harris or some of those players that may fit. And I think we focus so much on a lot of these top-tier guys, understandably so, but kind of seeing where the chip falls with different teams, who stays where. You know, does Milwaukee keep Chris Middleton? Like, you can go down a list of all these players that you start to kind of question and think where they're going to fall, who else is going to be freed up. And I do. I think the Nets have a variety of places that they want to maybe fill some gaps, but I think they're very comfortable with the core that they have, with the pieces they put in place, and just kind of where they're at because they have this type of flexibility now with their cap.
The other piece that, you know, Brooklyn's been eyeing is the same piece that a lot of teams have been eyeing, and that's Anthony Davis out there. Available via trade. The Pelicans have opened things up a little bit. They're looking at different offers right now. The public war of words has kind of, it already began, you know, back in February when this whole saga kind of started. But Rich Paul, who is on the cover of SI this week, a long story about him by Scott Price, one of our best writers here. He had some interesting comments in there, one of which was how it pertained to Boston, which is the team that I think most people agree that the Celtics decide to go all in for Anthony Davis. They can probably get Anthony Davis. But Rich Paul said, and I'm paraphrasing him here, that, you know, they've let Boston know that if they acquire Davis, it's a one-year rental, and that's it. You know, basically he's not going to re-sign there. How much should a team, in your opinion, take the words of an agent into account in a situation like this? Because I don't know for a fact if Paul George's agent warned off Oklahoma City. I don't know if that happened, but it worked out for Oklahoma City. We saw a lot of public stuff after Kawhi was traded to Toronto, that Kawhi has no interest in playing for Toronto. And who knows, a couple of days from now, a week from now, we may learn that Kawhi is going to stay in Toronto on some kind of deal. Should a team worry about the words of an agent in a situation like this?
I would. And I'm not a GM or a part of a front office or, you know, in that situation with the Celtics and where they sit and how they feel like this could change the complexion of the roster that they have and potentially compete for, because really it would be about, can we put ourselves in position that we're competing for a title that would entice a guy like Anthony Davis to stay? But this has been seemingly a consistent message from, and whether it's coming from the mouth of Rich Paul or just the signs that we've gotten from Anthony Davis and where he wants to go, I would be apprehensive if I were the Celtics how much I would be willing to give up, just because nothing has changed from the time this came out. And you could have your thoughts or opinions on just the way this has all been cultivated and just how everything has gotten to this point. But they've got valuable assets and some pieces that they probably, you know, do. We see these young guys and what they're becoming and how they're developing, and just, you may not want to part with those pieces or part with, you know, your valuable assets within the organization that you think could grow into something and make you, you know, as you're hoping to get to your title contending hopes, for someone that you could lose and then where are you sitting a year from now? And that would give me trepidation in what I would do in an Anthony Davis deal, how much I would be willing to give up, because the message has not changed about what would happen and his intents to not necessarily be in Boston.
Yeah, if the Celtics could get Kyrie to sign an extension or sign up long term, then it's a no-brainer.
Right.
Then you put all your chips in that basket and you pay no attention to the words of the agent, and you believe that the combination of Kyrie being there, and Kyrie's very close to Anthony Davis, along with the foundation that your organization has, along with the fact that you'd probably be a co-favorite to win the whole thing next year with Kyrie, Anthony Davis. Assume you keep Gordon Hayward. Assume you keep Al Horford. That's a big four that'll rival any teams in the NBA next year. But I'm with you. I mean, I had been told, you know, that even without Kyrie, they were still going to make a run at Anthony Davis. I'd be hesitant to put Jason Tatum in a deal like that. I'd even be hesitant to put Jaylen Brown in a deal like that, just because there's just no guarantees. And if you wind up dealing away those pieces and Anthony Davis walked after a year, you'd be back to square one before the Nets trade. Like, you just wouldn't have anything that would be left over from that deal. And you'd have like Hayward and maybe Horford and, you know, a bunch of young guys that you have with your middle of the pack draft picks. That to me is a pretty big roll of the dice, especially when if this Celtics team brings back that group, let's say they re-sign Rozier and tell him you're the starting point guard again, you're still a threat in the East. I don't know if you're the team to beat in the East, but you're still a threat because you got to a conference finals and one game away from the NBA finals with that group. That to me is a more practical play than going all in on Anthony Davis without the Kyrie presence there.
And I also think that the examples we've seen, which have been, you look at Oklahoma City, and that I think is a different organization in a different market that probably needs to operate in getting a top tier player in different ways than a Boston might. With the Toronto situation and Kawhi Leonard, the moves Masai Ujiri was making, obviously believing that they could be title contenders as they sit now prior to this trade, but also the confidence and the belief that they were comfortable, if Kawhi does walk, that they were going to be at a point that they wanted to get at. I don't know if you want to call it rebuilding, but the DeMar DeRozan contract was one that they were comfortable getting off of. The situation that they will find themselves in is one that they were okay with. You pretty much lose Jakob Poeltl, but otherwise they've got all, you still got Siakam, you still got Ananobi. So they are comfortable with what would happen if Kawhi Leonard leaves at the end of this season. I'm not sure that's where Boston wants to find itself after a year.
Yeah, I agree. That would be devastating if they lost all those pieces just for 1 year of Anthony Davis. I mean, I still think there might be Boston's not the team, but there might be a team that's in a situation like Toronto's in that will roll the dice. Maybe it's Chicago, maybe it's somebody else, and say, look, we're kind of in that middle of the pack place. We don't want to be. Either we keep Davis long-term or we rebuild. I think there'll be a team in the next couple of weeks that you start to hear about that we're not talking about right now that may be a factor. That's why I think David Griffin should and will take his time with this whole process. There's no rush. He's got the number one pick in the draft. Like, unless you're obsessed with number three and need R.J. Barrett on your team, or you're obsessed with number four and want Jarrett Culver or Darius Garland or any of the other guys that are mocked at that spot, you can wait this thing out till like mid-July if you want. You can wait till August.
Do you think they will, though? Do you think you
will? No, I think you'll wait till the first couple of days of free agency. I don't know if you do it on draft night. I don't know that there's that much of a need to do it that early, especially when all the dust settles, you don't know what it's going to look like out there. The other thing, too, with like, again, it goes back to how much does Kyrie Irving hate Boston? Like how much does he? Because the Celtics, I'm sure, either to him directly or behind the scenes, are saying, if you come back here, we're getting Anthony Davis. Like, you are not going back to the same dysfunctional group that you were frankly a part of, that you
right,
put on.
Right.
You're going back to a team that's you, Anthony Davis, Gordon, who you have for years talked about wanting to play with, who's going to be a better player next year, Al Horford, who everybody loves to play with. Like, that to me would be, that's the strongest indication that Boston was just poison for Kyrie Irving if he decides not to come back, knowing what the Celtics are able to do.
And that's where I think it's fascinating as we continue to talk about all the stuff with free agency. Like, the two notable players in Kevin Durant, Kyrie Irving, Kawhi Leonard are all relative in excellent positions and situations currently. So for as much as we keep thinking, whether it's New York or Brooklyn or, you know, whether it's Clippers or the Lakers, like, to me, there's still always a chance that these teams can persuade them into saying, look at what we have, look at the situation you're in, and do you want, what is moving you from wanting to be here? Do you just want to be in a different place? Is it really about getting away from the organization? Do we need to do more to put together a team that you believe can be a winner? So for all of this, I am fascinated to see how it all unfolds, because I do think whether it's other teams popping up that we're not necessarily talking about, or just what the organizations are currently in may be able to do in Anthony Davis, for as much as Kevin Durant has been a driving force in what happens with free agency and how that may be tweaked with this injury, I think the Anthony Davis trade and what David Griffin decides to do with him and how that all continues to proceed is going to be such an interesting piece in how this all plays out.
Yeah, going to be a wild July, that's for sure. Before we get there, we do have a game six tomorrow night Thursday.
Right.
On Thursday night, Warriors, they extended their season. Great win for them in game five. Last game in Oracle Arena, which I will not miss, by the way. Hard pass, like move to San Francisco.
I noticed you said that in the open.
It's a concrete slab in the middle. Like,
you mad
it's not
about the
open.
Wi-Fi?
It's just there's nothing nice about it.
Ray Ritter?
No, I love Ray Ritter. Who doesn't love Ray Ritter? It's an awful place. Like, put an arena in Oakland, but a new arena.
You don't like going over the bridge?
I don't mind going over the bridge. I'm good with Oakland. I mind that.
I feel nostalgic.
And
OCO
next door? How do they say? I don't know how they say. O.co, whatever.
I think it's O.co.
That's another dump. Like, it's another dump out there. Like, just enough already with Oracle Arena. Last game, no matter what, in Oracle Arena. How devastating was that game five loss to Toronto, do you think? I mean, this is a team that's overcome adversity before, but to be basically a Kyle Lowry shot away from a championship, how devastating do you think that was for Toronto? And do you think that Golden State is now back in this series?
I definitely think Golden State is back in the series. To me, and we can get into it, for all the talk and discussion and dialogue about Toronto, what Toronto did wrong, did right, Nick Nurse's, like, to me it was more like the Warriors won that game. It was less about Toronto losing it than more talk about some spectacular shots and plays and the grittiness, all the things you want to say. And after Kevin Durant went down and playing for Kevin, like, that's the stuff that, like, legends are made of. And this is why we love sports and love watching these games. So I think that Golden State is absolutely back in it. I don't think they were ever out of it. They've seen 3-1 series before from both sides. So I think that matters. I think having been in the position before matters. But I also think for Toronto, like, was it probably disappointing? Absolutely. Did you feel like you had a NBA title in your grasp and that you were just going to close it out because you put yourself in position 100%? But I do think what this team has been through, I do think being down in that Philadelphia series and having to win that game four and turn it around in the shot in game seven, I mean, just the manner in which they won that series, then being down 0-2 against Milwaukee, they have lived through adversity, and I think they are a team led by a lot of poise that, of course, we start with Kawhi Leonard, but I think it all matters. I think the experience of Danny Green, of Marc Gasol, I think for as much as we have talked about the decisions of Nick Nurse down the stretch, I think he's someone who has so much confidence and a looseness and a poise, and I don't think it should go unnoticed, even though it's been brought up about him winning championships internationally, winning championships in the G League. This is a whole different stage, and obviously the biggest stage in the world. But I think they'll come in with, I expect, I don't know if you can count out Golden State for game six. You certainly can't. But I expect Toronto to come in with the same type of confidence. I think they will have the same type of poise. And I think a lot of what we saw in game five was more about just extraordinary shooting, extraordinary play. I mean, the three-point line, difference maker in the game. And I think Toronto, this is something that they will embrace as part of the story of trying to get to where they are. And I do think they, whether it's game six or game seven, end up winning the series.
I think you're right that Toronto has overcome adversity before, and that I don't think they'll be broken by what happened in game five. but all the pressure shifted onto them because Golden State is now officially playing without Kevin Durant. They're no longer the favorites. They're not expected to win this series. So I think there's a looseness that they're going to play with in Game 6. And if they win Game 6, even though Game 7's in Toronto, this is a situation that Golden State is familiar with. Like, they've been in huge game sevens before. They've won them, they've lost them, but they've been in those situations before. You know, Toronto was in one a couple of series ago against Philadelphia. But if you had if you're the Raptors and you just lost two straight to Golden State, to this still daunting team, and you're going back home, the tightness they're going to feel in that game seven is going to be tough. Like, that's going to be a lot. I don't know. I don't want to think they should look at it like this is their season in game six. But this is a game they need to win. Like, the Golden State has to win it, but if you're Toronto, I think you got to feel like you need to win this game.
I agree. I think they would feel that way anyway. I think they probably felt that way about game five. Like, I think they are on the cusp of being so hungry and motivated for so many reasons. And the same could probably be said about Golden State. However, it's such different scenarios and situations. I'm sure the Raptors feel that way. However, I almost think the way that the game ended in game five will change the approach for which they enter this game, they start this game, and just I don't think that factors it. I don't think that makes them any tighter. I don't think that makes them I don't think they will feel the pressure in a negative way heading into game six, in a sense that it won't help. I think they will use the way the game finished in game five to their advantage heading into game six.
You know, we've been talking about how this finals and this season kind of burnishes the credentials of Kawhi Leonard. In the unlikely event that the Raptors cough up a 3-1 lead, does that reflect poorly on Kawhi Leonard? Because we're looking at him as this transcendent superstar that's on the level of all the greats in the NBA today. If he fails, if his team, the team he leads, fails to close out a 3-1 lead, does it diminish him at all?
I don't think so. I mean, I'll say two things on that. One, I mean, he has been a machine. I mean, he's been an absolute just vicious killer. I've been so impressed with him. I question and I wonder what we're going to hear after the finals, regardless of what he's dealing with, what's going on with his knee. I mean, I think he has been laboring through stuff that we probably can't even imagine or know about. And you could tell the way in which, even throughout the course of the game, like even throughout the course of last game, I think he's needing to be smart and diligent on how he just manages his exertion and what he does throughout the course of the game to be ready. When we saw him reel off that 10-point stretch, of which he was, I think a part of that too is him throughout the course of the game needing to be smart about how much energy he's expending, so at the end of the games he can do what we've seen him do. But no, I don't. I mean, I guess we see how the next two games plays out, because that obviously is going to be very telling. But I think Kawhi has firmly cemented himself on a superstar level, on a level of, we go into next season, him being talked about as one of the best players in the world, and, you know, where he's, especially since the expectation Kevin Durant won't be able to play. You know, we haven't seen LeBron James play in a while, so that, but no, I think regardless of how things finish out, it may tweak it if he helps Toronto win a title and is the driving force behind that, but I don't think it changes how we view him.
Should he have taken that shot?
No.
I mean, look, you say no, but we saw in the conference semis, he dribbled around a bunch of guys and then shot in the face of Joel Embiid at the end of a game.
But he was getting to his spot in the corner and on the bit, like, It's one thing to me shooting in the face of someone. It's another thing when you're getting blitzed and you've got two guys on. Like, the thing that I always, even more so, continue to be so impressed with Kawhi Leonard, he always makes the right decision. Like, even when he is being more aggressive or more assertive or looking for a shot more, he just seemingly always makes the correct decision with the ball in his hands. And that was a great, like, and I don't know if it was on the fly or obviously they weren't coming out of a timeout. I mean, it was coming off of a dead ball. But Andre Iguodala, when he came up and left his guy and came and doubled him, I don't know if that was a part of the game plan of,
just
of
how they've been playing,
but just a great feel for knowing we do not want Kawhi to, whoever else is going to take the last shot, we don't want it to be Kawhi. But no, and I think that's a part of why Toronto has been good, because they've relied on other players. And great defensive play by Draymond Green, tipping that Lowry shot. I mean, that, all of it. I think what changed at the end of the game, which we had not seen, was how Golden State played defense in a way that we hadn't been seeing throughout the earlier part of the finals. But in no way, shape, or form do I think Kawhi should have forced up a shot. I mean, that to me was going back to parts of what makes him so good, is because he's making the right play, the correct play. And you would hope that, you know, someone would have got off a better look. However, that was a culmination of not just the last shot, but a variety of things, mm-hmm. By which they lost that game.
Sarah Kustok, appreciate it. Maybe we can be best friends again.
Yes.
Maybe again. I will. Yes. Here's what I will do. I was going to wear Sarah's the worst on First Thing First this week. I was gonna.
You were gonna wear that when you were on?
Yeah, where it was on. Just to,
they probably wouldn't have let you on.
Yeah, probably not.
Nick already doesn't like you, so.
I'm not very easy to like. It's just, you know, you're. We can be best friends again. Rebecca Harlow still down the list. Bowles and Dam still down the list. Grady never coming off the shit list there. He can go back to doing popcorn segments for all I care.
Grady's my guy. I love Grady.
Protect your people, Sarah.
Grady's my guy, always.
Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
When we come back, my conversation with SI's Scott Price. All right, joining me now on the podcast, Scott Price, the senior writer over at Sports Illustrated. He is the author of this week's cover story on Rich Paul, the NBA agent, the close friend and agent of LeBron James, the man at the epicenter of the NBA offseason due to his relationship, his status as the agent for Anthony Davis. Scott Price joins me here on the podcast. Scott, what's going on, man?
Nothing much. Great to be here.
So let me ask you this. You went into this type of story without kind of all the baggage and the drama that came with kind of covering the NBA up until this point. What was kind of your curiosity, and what were you looking to learn in a story like this?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question, because essentially, I don't cover the NBA full time, I'm not in it obviously as a beat writer. I drop into it, and I have occasionally to do stories, but you know, of course, the AD trade demand was massive. And in speaking to the editors at SI, like we were back and forth, you know, wondering what this was saying about player empowerment and just sort of the whole changes in the league going forward. And of course, it was a dramatic and pivotal moment that had nothing to do with anything that happened on the court this year. And so I literally just wanted to know what just happened and why, and what the factors were going into it. And so I didn't know exactly, how it was going to shake out. I mean, Rich Paul clearly was at the center of it and was an intriguing figure, but I had no idea if he was going to talk to me or anybody else. I went into it certainly intent on doing the story, whether he spoke to me or not. I just wanted to do a deep dive into the NBA and just what this aquarium is like right now. And I went out to LA and talked to him a little bit, and the next day he said come out to the office, and he decided to talk to me. But it was the story obviously became more centered on him because he's at the center of it and he was willing to talk about it.
Yeah, he was willing to talk, and I think as you wrote in the story, you had about a 3-hour conversation during one of your sit downs with him. And
one of my sessions. Yeah.
Yeah, right. One of your sessions with him. I mean, when you were sitting there talking to him, what kind of sense did you get from him? What do you think he was trying to get across in those conversations?
Well, I think first off, I mean, there were two things. One is that, you know, obviously he had taken, you know, a lot of flack. So I think he was looking to air, you know, a defense of himself. I mean, and his actions. He also was much calmer. There are parts where he gets very emotional, but overall, I was struck by how how calm the situation was, considering the cyclone that had been sort of, you know, flying around him, you know, partially obviously of his own making, and so I found that interesting. The other thing was is that, you know, in speaking about what happened with AD in New Orleans, and of course he's mentioned, you know, going to free agency and talking about the Celtics, which a lot of people have focused on, I think, so far. And his whole thing was, I'm trying to do you a courtesy, which is, you know, I'm going to let you know our intentions so you can act on it. And I found that interesting, to say the least. And in both instances, you know, he obviously knows what he's doing, but that's how he was framing it.
You know, one of the things he got mentioned in the story and tried to get across the story is that all he's experienced in his life, the blowback, it doesn't, you know, he's experienced worse, basically, to put it in one
yes.
way. Do you think, though, that all the blowback that Rich has received over the last 6 months, do you think it has gotten to him? Do you think it's affected him?
Well, let me say two things. One is that he, over and over, and I'm sure I'm not the first person he said this to, he said, you know, people are using this, you know, language of disaster. He says, I know what a disaster is. Nobody got killed here. You know, what do we say? Everyone's going to get paid. You know, obviously, what are we talking about? And he obviously wanted to stress the perspective of growing up in Glenville and a really tough neighborhood in Cleveland and, you know, everything that I detail in the story. Yeah, but I think, you know, he's like everybody. I think he's there like every human. I mean, the fact is that people who say, it doesn't bother me, I don't read anything, it turns out that, sure, of course. I think he's sensitive. I think that he does not like the flack he's taking. He does, on the other hand, understand that it's part of the job. And, you know, one of the interesting things was, he's like, of course, you know, you're going to say that I got my job because of my friendship with LeBron. It's true. He said, no, just point me to one person who succeeded in life who didn't get a leg up from somewhere else. So he has ready-made, you know, answers and defenses to charges that he's extremely well aware of and I think he's sensitive to.
You know, one of the questions that came up during the Anthony Davis stuff that first happened back in January was Rich Paul looking out for Anthony Davis, or was he looking out for LeBron James, who is the backbone of everything that Rich Paul does, or has or at least of what he's gotten up until this
sure.
point?
Yeah.
He addresses that in the story. He talks about how L.A. is still a desirable location for any player, LeBron or otherwise. But what was your read on that? I mean, how much of the Davis stuff, from what you were able to glean, was about just Davis, or how much of it was about Davis and LeBron?
Well, he certainly framed it as it being about Davis. Now, I mean, the interesting thing is this. I mean, he didn't – what I like or what I found interesting was he didn't say – this has nothing at all to do with LeBron whatsoever. He didn't put it that way, which would have been unbelievable, of course. But, you know, you speak to agents all the time. They certainly spin in extremes all the time. What he said was yeah, you take LeBron off the Lakers, and the Lakers are still a great destination. And when LeBron's much older, and LA is still a great destination for him. Does it help LeBron? Sure. And if I can help LeBron while helping Anthony Davis at the same time, great. Like, he's not against the idea at all. He says, but my priority is Anthony Davis. So, I mean, to be honest, I don't have any more insight into, well, actually, I think he's secretly working all the way for LeBron and would put Anthony Davis in a detrimental situation only to help out LeBron. I certainly didn't get that impression. You know, that's not what he said to me. That's not how he answered the question. And, you know, I the one thing I do have to say is, this is about their money, you know, and, you know, I spoke to Draymond Green about this, you know, it's like, he's like, I've got lots of friends. I'm not that good a friend where I'm going to put my friend in charge of my money. Like, my money's too important to me. So I do think there's a certain logic where the one thing that nobody really wants to say, and, or at least it's always, you know, LeBron's the puppeteer, Rich Paul's the puppeteer, and Anthony Davis is sort of let off the hook. But as, you know, Jeff Van Gundy and others say, and I tend to understand this, Anthony Davis is the boss. I mean, whether you like it or not, it's his decision, or it will be his decision in the long run, and he's the one who really ultimately is responsible for the good and the bad that comes with that. Rich Paul works for him. But, of course, nobody really wants to articulate that too much. It's a strange thing, and I understand it because LeBron has such clout, and Rich Paul obviously has clout by virtue of that. But I just thought it was interesting when Anthony Davis went on. First of all, his most extensive comments were on LeBron's show, which I think is interesting. Mm-hmm. Now, you can say, well, that's, you know, he's part of Clutch, and it's a Rich Paul thing. On the other hand, maybe he just really likes LeBron and loves L.A. and has a house there. So it's really difficult to parse through all this, as you know, and as everybody who's been trying to parse through it for the last 4 years is. So I don't have a hard and fast answer for you on it, but I admit that it's intriguing, I got to say.
The Boston angle, as you mentioned, and that quote that Rich gave to you about the Celtics, that's going to be everywhere in the New England area for the next couple of days. But this has been an ongoing narrative, right, where it seems like the Celtics are really interested in Anthony Davis and have been for over a year. And the narrative coming out of Anthony Davis's camp, specifically Rich Paul, has been that Anthony Davis is not interested in Boston. That was taken to another level when, you know, off the top ropes, here comes Anthony Davis's father bringing up Isaiah Thomas,
right,
of all people.
Exactly.
Who, by
right,
the way, Isaiah Thomas, just for the record, Isaiah Thomas tried to sign back with Boston last summer and would happily accept a deal from him this summer. That whole quote never made any sense.
Right.
You know, what are you able to learn about? What is it about the Boston situation that Rich Paul believes doesn't make sense for Anthony Davis? Because if it's just about winning, that seems to be something Boston could offer. Did you get any sense of why he's very much against any type of commitment to Boston?
No, he never got into what is wrong with Boston. What is the problem with Boston? I do not have that answer. And I will tell you, you know, the interesting thing to me is over and over, you know, obviously that part is said, but he also said, you know, where's he going to land? I have no idea, and it don't matter. He said, we're going into free agency. I mean, one of the craziest, not craziest, but quotes I liked the best was that he actually said, Earth, colon, like literally like an announcement to Earth. We're going into free agency. He's going to play. Anthony Davis is going to play 1 year, and then he's going to free agency no matter where he is. And so obviously the Boston piece of this is central to, clearly, to fans in the Northeast. I can't tell you what the problem is with Boston. I never got to the heart of that.
You talked to LeBron for this story as well. What was it about? What was your takeaway from your conversation with LeBron about his view of the relationship with Rich Paul?
I mean, there are two things. I mean, obviously, you know, he's well aware that his relationship is what made Rich Paul, and LeBron loves that idea about himself. He loves the idea that he has elevated his friends and that his friends not only, you know, were given an opportunity through their association with LeBron, but then have taken that opportunity and run with it. I mean, the fact is, you know, he's not just LeBron's agent. You know, he's got 25 other players, including Ben Simmons and you know, Draymond and Anthony Davis and others, and you know, Darius Garland and who's coming up in the draft. So LeBron loves that he was the person who made that possible, but he also loves that he believes, or he likes to state, that he has nothing to do with these successes of Rich Paul since. A little bit of that is, you know, extremely hard to parse, because of course we don't know how many people, how many players want to sign specifically to be close with LeBron or to follow LeBron's template into, you know, other media areas and so on and so forth. But LeBron loves that. And the other thing is that he really, one thing that really did strike me is that, you know, you look at LeBron, you look at Rich Paul, and you think, what do they have in common? Like, what, you know, where did that friendship, why is he so clearly, has such a great regard for Rich Paul? And a lot of it has to do with the commonalities of their backgrounds, where they grew up, how they grew up, the fact that they survived, and that he feels he can trust him and could trust him at an early age. So I really got a sense of that personal bond and regard that LeBron has for Rich Paul. It's much more of an equal relationship in his eyes than I expect.
I think it's great, too, that this all can kind of be traced back to a Warren Moon jersey. Like, if Rich, yeah. if Rich Paul on the plane where he met LeBron James was wearing a different jersey, none of this might have happened. None
right.
of this.
If he was wearing Fran Tarkenton, or if he was wearing Dan Marino, or, you know, whatever, some jersey, it was Warren Moon. And he says, you know, I mean, it was completely random, because obviously he had a great collection. So it's one of those, you know, Harrison Ford was supposedly discovered, you know, while building George Lucas's cabinets. You know, it's just one of those things where if they hadn't bumped into each other, then we wouldn't be having this conversation.
You wrote something in there, and you kind of touched on it a little bit, about how the LeBron connection makes it hard to parse where Rich Paul's yeah. talent ends and James's aura begins. Along those lines, do you think that whenever LeBron's career is over, that Rich will still be cemented as a top-tier agent, or will his power diminish? And I know it's just guesswork right now, once LeBron yeah. is gone.
Well, I think, you know, you look at someone like David Falk. I mean, obviously, you know, he was Jordan's agent, Michael Jordan. He was Patrick Ewing. And when those players began to fade, I mean, Falk was as powerful an agent as the league has ever seen in many ways. And there's no question that it is, you know, power by association that faded for David Falk. And I'll LeBron has an outsized presence in the league and frankly, outside the league at this point in the culture. So there's no question that when that begins to fade, I think Rich Paul's clout does begin to fade. I mean, again, however, you know, it depends on who he picks up next. And also how much the players that he currently has grow. I mean, if Ben Simmons ends up winning 3 titles or something and Rich Paul is still his agent, maybe that still keeps on rolling. But I think Falk is an instructive figure. I think it has to fade because these are once-in-a-generation players, LeBron and Michael Jordan.
The last question I have for you is, Rich laid a lot of the problems that happened during the Davis stuff before the trade deadline at the feet of Dell Demps. He said Dell tried to go around him, that Dell was kind of the source of all the news coming out there. Just you wrote in the story that Dell was not reachable for comment, not available for
right.
comment. What kind of efforts did you make to get a hold of Dell Demps?
Oh, I called him. I got a hold of his number and called him, you know, innumerable times. And then I was in New Orleans, so I ended up, you know, writing a note and putting it in an envelope and going to his house and leaving a note in his mailbox. I don't think he was home that weekend, but I put my card and my number and everything else. And a young woman, it may well have been his daughter, came to the door, very, very nice, actually, kind of puzzled by what I was doing there outside the gate. And she was very nice, but said, yeah, he's not there. And that was that. But I made every effort because you know, obviously you want to get all sides of the story. And Dell, as far as I know, has not really gone into detail his side of what happened. And I think it's a fascinating one. And I think it would have been a better tale to tell if I'd had both sides, both to tell the story correctly and to be fair to Dell as well, because, obviously Rich Paul gets his say here. Maybe that in the end will, you know, prompt Dell to come out and speak to somebody about it. But I made every effort. I tried to talk to a lot of people and some wanted to talk, some said they wanted to talk, some started to talk, some stopped talking, some spoke quite a bit, you know, but it was a very interesting dance. The NBA has become a far more complex and interesting universe than when I covered it.
Yeah, no question about that. Let me add one more thing. LeBron's now with the Lakers. The influence Rich Paul has within the Lakers right now, how would you characterize it?
Well, you know, it's funny because, we found out, you know, that, or at least we have a source that tells us that Rich had approached an NBA coach about a place on Vogel's staff. Rich denies and the Lakers deny it. And then it's funny because the Lakers, a spokesperson for the Lakers said, oh, that's not true. Everyone knows LeVar Ball runs the team, which I thought was a pretty flip but funny line. And frankly, the fact that they were so loose about it, there's certainly a feel in the league that Clutch has an outsized influence on the Lakers. And I think, obviously, into a vacuum, the power will rush, you know, and LeBron is that kind of presence. He's certainly the strongest, most monumental figure in the franchise right now. But I will say that, you know, Ty Lue didn't get a five-year contract offer, which is what he wanted, and walked away. And the Lakers were only offering three. And so my feeling is that if the Lakers, if Clutch was truly running the Lakers, Ty Lue would have gotten that five-year deal. So at the very least, I think Rich Paul and LeBron obviously have a strong voice in the organization right now, but I don't think they're the be-all and end-all for the moment.
Well, it's a terrific story. You can catch it. It's on the cover of SI this week. You can read it on SI.com right now. Scott, you're welcome back to the NBA Beat anytime, my friend. Come on back and join us in the day-to-day.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
At Humana, our Medicare Advantage plans give you coverage and care you can count on, along with guided support to help you feel your best. You could have a plan with a $0 premium or an all-in-one plan that may include medical and prescription coverage, as well as routine dental, vision, and hearing. Learn more at GetHumana.com. Humana, a more human way to healthcare. Humana is a Medicare Advantage HMO and PPO organization with a Medicare contract. Enrollment in any Humana plan depends on contract renewal.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.